Today's program has been brought to you by the International Culinary Center, offering courses that range from classic French techniques in culinary, pastry, and bread baking to Italian studies to management, from culinary technology to food writing, from cake making to wine tasting. For more information, visit internationalculinarycenter.com. Broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to heritageradionetwork.org.
Welcome to Cooking Issues. This is Dave Arnold, your host of Cooking Issues, coming to you live every Tuesday from roughly 12 to roughly 12:45 at the Heritage Radio Network in the back of Roberta's Pizzeria in Bushwick, Brooklyn. Jack decided not to show up today because
it's his girlfriend's birthday.
Well, we had the fundraiser over the weekend, and now he's just too big for us, right, Joe?
Yeah, he's doing presidential things right now, I'm guessing.
Yeah, he's just, you know, he's like smoking, you know, tobacco rolled in $100 bills and all kinds of crazy stuff over there in the Heritage Radio headquarters. But thankfully, Joe is with us, and as always, Nastasha the Hammer Lopez, how you doing?
Good.
Yeah. Apologize that we were not able to do the live cooking issues with Harold McGee over at the Harvard because we just couldn't do it. That's all there was to it. We couldn't do it. We were prepping out. The class started as the show would have been ending, and that would have been a big poop show had we done that, right?
Mm-hmm.
True. So, speaking of McGee, Harold McGee and I will be in London, and we're going to go to the Brogdale in Faversham, where Nastasha and I went like a year and a half ago, maybe.
Yeah.
It was 2 years ago?
2 years ago.
2 years ago?
Mm-hmm.
And it is... Well, okay, look. All right, fine. Geneva, New York, is where all of our, when I say our, I mean the good old US of A, where all of our apples are stored. And the way you store an apple is by planting trees, right? So they don't just like literally store, I mean, they also store seeds in liquid nitrogen like sperm banks, but a lot of people don't really believe in that because they think that the seeds might mutate over time, etc., blah, blah, blah. People like to own the freaking trees, right? Then also, if you have the trees, you can see how they respond to various things. And the reason that our tax money goes to it isn't because the people who decide the tax money stuff think that, you know, we should have wide variety of delicious apples. They're more worried that some crazy apple disease is going to come through and kill every apple except that one crazy variety that they saved, right? At least that's the original genesis, the reason there's money behind this project. And so all of our apples are in Geneva. And Geneva, New York has the greatest collection of apples anywhere in the world. But, the Brogdale in Faversham in Kent, England, an hour outside of London, is where they have the largest culinary apple collection. So the way they get around this is there's a crazy guy, Phil Forsline, who used to go to Kazakhstan, which is where apples come from, and he would gather all kind of wild apples. I don't know how the hell he smuggled the seeds back into the U.S. or went through some crazy quarantine situation or whatever, because they have a huge genetic diversity of different apple varieties, as well as other fruits, actually, in this thing called the Tian Shan Fruit Forest, which stretches from China to Kazakhstan, and it's a huge, kind of apparently incredibly beautiful, awesome place, and one of the places on Earth, actually, that I really want to go. Anyway, so he went there and just collected a bajillion different kinds of wild, malus apple species and planted them at Cornell up in Geneva, and it obliterated the Brogdale's collection in terms of sheer numbers. But Brogdale has the culinary apple collection to beat in the world. However, I'm extremely partial to the flavor of apples as grown in upstate New York. So we've been to the apple collection, but when we went to the Brogdale apple collection, Nastasha and I was sidelined by the fact that they also have an incredibly awesome collection of pears. And actually, you know what we missed last time? There should still be a couple plums on the trees. But see, but it's nut season, so they're going to have all the nuts. In fact, we're going to miss the nut festival. I mean, it'll be the Nut Festival with Harold and I there, but we're going to miss the official Nut Festival by a couple of days. Here's what's amazing about the Brogdale and why anyone that lives anywhere near London and doesn't or hasn't been to the Brogdale a bunch of times honestly should be incredibly ashamed of themselves. They should just be, you know, you should be, I don't know, you should wear a hair shirt and a dunce cap and go into the corner and just, you know, beat yourself with sticks out of, you know, anguish that you've missed this huge portion of your life so close to this amazing resource and you haven't gone yet. Would you say it's accurate?
They could join you, can't they?
I don't know. I don't know exactly what time I'm going to be. McGee and I, well, first of all, look. So the Brogdale, unlike us, where our pears are in Corvallis, Oregon, and our berries are in Corvallis, Oregon, and we have our apples in Geneva, New York, and our collections of germplasm are spread all over the country, the English basically can only grow stuff in Kent. come on, no offense. But you can take offense if you want. But anyway, so their entire collection of stuff is at this one place. So it's kind of one-stop shopping for everything. Small fruits, and you know, the English, they know gooseberries like nobody else. They have like the gooseberry collection, but not the time of year. Anyway, apples, pears, nuts, plums, cherries, Kentish cherries. You know, anyways, so my point is that I'm going to temperate fruit paradise on Friday. Like my plane lands. McGee and I, he's coming from California, I'm coming from New York. We're meeting at Heathrow and taking a train directly to Faversham. I'm gonna throw away all, I'm not even gonna wear clothes. I'm just gonna dress myself in fruit and then take that fruit because we're going to our good buddy, Tony Canellaro, and Ria's wedding. Congratulations to them. You know, one of my favorite bartenders in the whole world. Yeah?
Yep.
Okay. Calling your questions live to 718-497-2128. That's 718-497-2128. Joe, who's bringing the show to us today?
It would be the International Culinary Center.
The International Culinary Center. I'm doing actually a demo with them tomorrow. Are you coming to that thing or no?
Aren't you going today to figure?
I'm going to go there today to talk to them, but I mean, I don't think our viewers care about that. You're going to be there? Okay. We're doing a demo for PepsiCo, right? Pepsi. Anyway, okay, questions. Hey, Dave, Nastasha, Jack, and Joe. Although Jack doesn't care about your question, Ron, because he's not here to listen to it. I'm just kidding. I'm just messing with Jack. Several shows back, We Pop's, you know, We Pop Superpot, our intern, and one of the current founders and designers, I'm assuming, of the Namico Immersion Circulator. Several shows back, We Pop called to talk to you about the Namico. Namico or Namico? Co, right?
Coo? Yeah.
Coo. Okay. The Immersion Circulator designed for use in the home kitchen. Needless to say, I was extremely excited at the prospect of having an affordable, low-temp cooking solution out in the market. Recently, I was on the Polyscience website and found out that they now also offer a home version called the Creative Series. And it's called, like, yeah, it's all like sous vide, and there's a sous vide creative and the sous vide professional, and then there's the old metal one, so it's kind of confusing. But you go on the website and you look at it. I think it's live on the website. I haven't seen one in real life. Anyway, hold on. So the Namico will be $140 cheaper than the sous vide creative from Polyscience. The heater in the Namico is going to have less wattage, 750 versus 1100, although I really think Philips is 1000 watts. The heater itself is 1000. I don't think it's 1100, but anyway, whatever. But the pump is more powerful in the Namico, 10 liters per minute versus 6 liters per minute. The Namico claims it can actually get water to 100 degrees C, while the Creative goes to 99 degrees C. I mean, that's a meaningless stat, though. I mean, I wouldn't even pay attention to that. That's a meaningless stat. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, that's, you know, don't worry about that. You're not going to want to put these into anything other than water anyway. See, the old metal ones with stainless steel. Let me finish your question first before I go crazy. Okay. The rest of the specs, as far as I can tell, are about the same. Not sure if you had a chance to play with either, perhaps a Namico prototype, but I'm hoping you can give us your honest opinion on which one you would get. I'm not planning on getting one until the holidays, so the fact that the Namico isn't actually out yet will not affect my purchasing decision. Also, I'm currently a student at the ICC, and I hear you'll be teaching a few classes this month. Is that true? I'm in level 6, which is the last level. It's the level that the students cook in the restaurant. So at the school, there's 6 levels. The last 2 levels cook in the restaurant. So the first 2, you're kind of learning stuff. The third one, more learning stuff. Fourth one, you're doing family meal for the whole school, and 5 and 6, you're in the restaurant. Okay. If you're around, I'll be sure to say hi. I'll be the giddy Chinese guy with the sweaty palms. Thanks. Love the show. Ron Fan. So, Ron, obviously not if you have sweaty palms, not a good chocolate worker. Shouldn't work with chocolate. Don't go into pastry, my friend. I mean, I guess you could, but I mean, if you have sweaty palms, it's going to be difficult working with chocolate and pastry, correct?
Yeah.
I mean, there are certain people who are, it's a known thing, certain people have warmer palms, and they have a very difficult time with things like chocolates. Just a known fact. Anyway. Okay. Before I even get into this, look, WePop is a friend of mine. I love myself, WePop. And Philip Preston is a friend of mine, and I've known him for many, many years. And he's been very supportive. So it's very hard for me to come. I almost can't come down with any sort of recommendation on one versus the other, because it's just, it would be crazy for me. You know what I'm saying? What do you think, Stas? I mean, that's kind of like, you know, Philip Preston has been.
But we're gonna get one in December. He's shipping.
Which
us.
The we Philip, pop, the new one?
We pop is sending us
the Namaku.
The Namaku
in December.
Yes.
All right. I haven't touched the new creative series yet. But I sent a note over to Philip, and I was like, Philip, what should I know about the creative system as opposed to the other one? And his response was, is that this new one, the $499 one, is designed to have a good control, very good temperature control, just like the other one. Have it be quiet, right? So I guess it's quieter for a home kind of situation. So the pump's not as loud, also not as you know, fast, right? It's a less demanding use, right? Because it's not meant to run all day, every day like ours do, which isn't to say you can't do a 72-hour cook, but, you know, the way these things are treated in professional kitchens is crazy. They're running almost 24/7 sometimes, you know, all the time. So the current one's not designed to run all day, every day. It's got a lower cost, you know, $499. So I don't really know actually what the Namaku is coming in. Is it really $170 cheaper? Is it really $320?
I don't know.
I mean, it's hard to say. Also, you never know if it's going to be sold at Williams-Sonoma. Williams-Sonoma, like, there's a retail price, and then Williams-Sonoma is going to give you a deal or something like that. So it's very hard to say what the price is going to be. The new PolyScience is going to have the same safety system as the old one did, plus a float. Which I never was a big fan of float, the float things. People like, so the float is basically in there, so in case your water runs low, the float drops and turns off the circulator. I've never been a giant fan of floats because it just seems like it's another thing that can fail, as opposed to having the strap-on. There's a strap-on thermometer, you know, a temperature sensor on the heating element itself, such that it goes over temp, it will shut the equipment off. So I guess Philip, enough people wanted a float plus that safety system, so he put it in. It has a smaller pump than the $800 one, so it's going to have a reduced capacity. On the note of capacity, by the way, capacity is one of those things that you can't really ever listen to what anybody says unless they're extremely specific about what they mean by capacity. So your capacity is going to be limited by the wattage. There's two things that limit your capacity. One is your ability to circulate water. That is rarely the limit. Except for in very large tanks or in viscous fluids like oils, which I wouldn't necessarily be circulating with these guys anyway. So the pump output is not usually the limit on your capacity. Usually the limit on your capacity is the wattage. And that said, also when you're judging capacity, the question is not how many liters of liquid, it's how many liters of liquid plus product at what temperature in a vessel with what kind of insulation. So there's so many variables, but the physics are what the physics are, and you can figure out how much roughly wattage you need with some back of the envelope calculations. So for me, the main thing is, when I was talking to Wepop, the new circulator, the Namaku, is you know, it has a smaller capacity, and it's designed to have a smaller capacity at 750 watts. And their feeling is that's enough wattage to get away with most of the things that you're going to want to do in your house. But they opted to have a more powerful pump, whereas Philip was like, I don't care about the pump, but I want to keep the same wattage. Because I don't actually know why they took the wattage down to 750. Wepop told me once, but I can't remember what his explanation was, because not, I mean, it could have been fitting it into the package, because it's a very thin stick package. The Namaku also is very small, right?
Yeah.
I mean, we haven't played with it yet. I mean, small is good, because small means it takes up less space in your bath. Anytime you can take up less space in your bath, it's probably a good thing. Just because that space you can't be cooking products in. So that might be an advantage for the Namaku, but really I hesitate to make any recommendations until I play with both of them. I will say this, it is an extremely exciting time to be a cook, because now almost anyone, you know, look, it's still expensive, you know, even if it's $350, it's not like I'm going to go out, you know, you're not like going to go out and buy them like their potato chips or pretzels, but it's in the realm of things that many, many people buy. I think there's a huge price difference between $800 and $400 or $350, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's a big difference.
Big difference.
I mean, Nastasha might actually consider purchasing one instead of other, yes, I said you might consider actually purchasing one. Yes. Yeah, we'll leave it at that. We'll just leave it right there. Yeah? Okay. So, right, that's pretty much, I mean, that's all there is to say about that, yeah?
Yeah.
All right.
When we get it, we will tell.
When we get it, we will tell the pros and cons of each. One, if you know me, my one of the main problems is I'm going to find it difficult to lie. So, right? I mean, like, it's, you know, it's, I mean, I can lie about many things, but not about recommending equipment. It's just a weird thing. And, and I know I'm not teaching a class this week, as far as I know.
You're doing sous vide next week.
Sous vide intensive?
Last week in September.
Is that next week?
No, 2 weeks from now.
Oh, so I will be in, is the class full?
I don't know.
If you want to come hear us spout off some crazy stuff. It's actually the best course that we've ever taught. I mean, like, not the best, but it's a good course for people who want to learn low temperature and sous vide. I'll put it this way. I'm proud of what we do in the course because we can do things that are very difficult for you to do in either a home or a restaurant kitchen just for time and space reasons. Anyway, so I guess we're teaching that in a couple of weeks, last week of September. So that's when I'll be in there, Ron. I'll be in tomorrow, but I'll be dealing with the Pepsi people. Okay. Should we take our first corner break?
Signing books. Yeah.
Signing books? What books? Anyway.
Techniques.
Coming right back with cooking issues.
You're listening to Miss the Morris by Jack Insel.
International Culinary Center is a proud sponsor of the HeritageRadioNetwork.org. The ICC, with locations in New York and California, provide cutting-edge education to future chefs, restaurateurs, and wine professionals. We're proud to claim Dan Barber, Bobby Flay, and David Chang among our honored alumni. This is Dorothy Cann Hamilton from Chef Story. Check out our ICC website at internationalculinarycenter.com.
And welcome back. Okay, we have a question in from Paul, who says, for ethical dietary reasons, I've been baking croissants with margarine. They turn out very nice, but I'm wondering if I can get something closer to authentic if I adjust the fat in the, in quotes, because it's not butter, butter block. The two main problems I think I face is that, one, as far as I can tell, it's impossible to get unsalted margarine. And two, I am guessing margarine has a higher water content compared to butter. Secondary issues could include altered melting point, issues with saturated fat or trans fat content, etc. I'm wondering if it might be possible to approximate something closer to unsalted butter in water content and reduce salt levels by making a mixture of margarine and vegetable shortening, or possibly trying to match the water content by evaporating moisture from margarine, but likely increasing the salt levels on a per volume level. If it matters, the dough is relatively wet, moderately enriched with a small amount of fat and some sugar, given a very quick mix with low gluten development, but then spends 12 plus hours in the fridge for a rise and a developed gluten and flavor. Any thoughts? Thanks, Paul. Okay, so, here's the thing. First of all, you know, you have to be making sure anyway that you're using a margarine that has, if you don't want the butter, I'm assuming you don't want, assuming you want vegan, right? That's the assumption, right? And so, you know, therefore, I'm sure you're aware of the fact that many margarines contain milk products in it for flavor. Some are artificially butter flavored, and I'm sure you can get just a plastic fat without the flavoring. But right or wrong,
right?
Yeah. Okay. So here's the thing. I did some preliminary poking around. It's been a long time since I've researched margarine because I do eat dairy, and so I'm a margarine. I'm a hater, right? I'm a hater. But the key thing, margarines, I guess, can have different water levels in it. But the key thing about a margarine, so butter is what butter is, right? It's butter fat, right, from cream. And the recipes that we have are written around the properties of butter. So butter is actually less than ideal for certain things. For instance, if you're going to do puff paste, and you have to keep the dough temperatures relatively proper, otherwise the butter gets too hard relative to the dough, right? Because butter isn't necessarily the best actual physical form for everything you're going to do. So when you're making margarine, you get to choose a lot of the exact properties that make it important for. So there's table margarines, right? And those are meant to spread mostly like butter. And the main characteristic that you're looking at, other than nowadays they're much better at it. Like margarine used to taste really Christ awful because they couldn't deodorize it properly, and they just tasted of awfulness. Because the way you make the margarine is you press like any old crud, I mean, unless it's specified. But you press any old crud, and you extract oil from things like seeds, soybeans, whatever. Usually with some crazy solvent, some sort of like light petroleum fraction, which you then get rid of. You're then left with oil plus gum and sludge and oil breakdown products, which are one of the things they can do with. So if there's too many free fatty acids in there, they add lye to it, and that turns it into soap, and then they wash the soap away. So there's, and by the way, none of this I'm against. I'm not saying I'm against that. I'm definitely pro, you know, that kind of a technique. So then they wash away all the impurities, and then they usually deodorize it. And when they're going to make margarine, they sometimes do the deodorization step at the end. So then you're left with these raw inputs that have various different fatty acid profiles, and then they hydrogenate them to different levels and different amounts and in different ways to obtain different properties of fat. And the most important property of fat, other than the taste of it, is and how it crystallizes, how a particular fat crystallizes, because that really affects its properties quite severely. But the other really important thing is called the SFI, which is the what does it actually stand for? Jeez, solid fractions index, I think, or solids. Anyway, so what it is it's a chart, and you can see it, and it's how much of a given fat is liquid at any given temperature. Because the fats are not one unitary type of thing, they don't have a definite melting point, right? And that's why butter gets softer as it gets warmer. It doesn't just instantly melt. It gets soft. It goes from hard to soft to melted, because there's a range of different compounds in there that have different melting points. And so there's the where that curve, the melting curve is, and then there's the slope of that curve determines over what temperatures fat is plastic, is workable. So the good news about margarines is that they can choose that exact profile for baking. And the profile that they choose for baking is different depending on the application that you're going to use. So they make ones called baker's margarine that are specifically designed to not be too hard, so they don't rip through layers of your product, but also not to melt at all until you are baking with them. So and there's different ones depending on exactly how the dough is supposed to work. So in the very industrial scale, they'll have a different one for a puff pastry than they will for a Danish or for a croissant, because they work slightly differently. Because a lot depends on the idea being not to tear the dough when you're rolling it out and what you're looking for. But the most important thing with those margarines is that they not melt out into the dough and cause adhesion of the layers to themselves before they're baked out. Like, that's the key thing. So there's that in conjunction with the not ripping. On water content, I wasn't able to find the app. So I looked this morning trying to find anyone that sold these varieties of margarines to the public. Like, I looked on Amazon for Baker's margarine, and I couldn't find it. Chet Baker the musician, had a song called Margarine. I was able to find that. You can download that for 99 cents. But I wasn't able to find less than 50 pounds of Baker's Margarine, and no one that kind of sold normally to us. So if anyone out there knows a source of Baker's Margarine, I'd appreciate it. And so and they're technically highly superior products. They just, they also add a lot of other stuff like oils and whatnot. Butter, fake butter flavor and whatnot. Now, as for your question, I wasn't able to find the optimum water content for the margarine, but there's a question as to what the optimum water content is in a dough like this, because after all, it's the water vaporizing, and in the thing as it melts that is causing the expansion to break the different flaky sections of the dough apart. In addition to, in croissant, obviously, it's also leavened. So, yes, and I know, I've known for years that people want and they love the low water European butters. For instance, like in the supermarket, you can buy Plougras for this kind of thing. But I never have actually done the test of how important the water content is. I'm loath to suggest adding, although, you know what? Crisco makes some flaky freaking stuff. Although, when I'm making pie crust with Crisco, it's a different kind of flaky, and there is a lot of fat melting in, because I'm not a believer in hyper-cold everything when you're making pie crust. I follow the kind of Jeffrey Steingarten through Marion Cunningham pie crust recipe of hand rubbing and not worrying about the temperature too much, and no one complains about my pie crust, but you do get some bleed out of the fat into the flour in that. And I use lard for that, which is actually more, when I use lard, it's actually colder because lard's much more difficult to work with than shortening is. But when I use Crisco shortening, it works. So you know what? It might work if you really want to lower the water content. Beat some Crisco into the margarine, like roll it in, like, you know, whip it and then flatten it and make it into a block. It could work, but I mean, most margarines I think are rocking in around the 20% water range in that area, 17 to 20, and most butters are also in that same range. So I doubt the water is an issue, but maybe it is. What I would recommend is not obviously melting the margarine to try and get the water out of it, because then you're breaking the emulsion, right? Right? Fair?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. What do you think? Is that a valid answer?
Yes.
Did I give anything of use? Sometimes I can't tell whether I've said any freaking thing useful at all. I just can't tell. Michael from Oakland writes in again, and now I feel bad. He's like, hey guys, welcome back from Colombia. Following up on the lucuma question from a few weeks ago, again, I make a cocktail with lucuma and was looking for an easier to locate substitute, something I could find in a local market, specialty market, or Latin market. You asked me to tell you whether I was concerned with taste or feel or something else. It's the taste I care about. Thanks for looking into this. And so does anyone out there, please help us out. Help us out. Get us a good source of lucuma and or lucuma substitute, because the closest thing I have is Canastel, because I never actually worked with lucuma directly. I work with Canastel.
I like Canastel.
Delicious, right? That's a good product.
That's good.
Yeah. So I've never had to source it. So someone help me out. Help us out. Just help us out. With that, let's go to our second commercial break. Cooking Issues.
Erotic.
Got Stitcher? Heritage Radio Network is on it, so get it. Stitcher is an award-winning provider of news and talk radio for your mobile phone. Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio.
Are we back?
We're back!
With cooking issues. Joe, do you remember, did we answer the question about raw milk safety last week? Or 2 weeks ago?
Oh.
Yeah, just check that out. I'm gonna answer another question in the meantime. Greetings, Nastasha, Dave, that's me. Jack and Joe, from Kevin Scott in San Jose. By the way, San Jose, visited San Jose where our other, the sister school is for the ICC. And it is almost impossible to find anything to freaking eat in San Jose after midnight. You know what I'm saying? You ever go hang out in San Jose? No, you're a Southern California.
But my college was near there.
It's in Stanford. How close is that to San Jose?
Pretty close. Closer than San Francisco.
Really?
Yeah, but no, I never ate there.
Yeah, anyway, apparently, like, somewhere there's, like, the late-night taco stands that are supposed to be good, but no one could point us out. They're like, man. So, you know, I was starving one night in San Jose, so, Kevin, if you can hook us up with the next time I'm in San Jose where I should get good food after midnight, I would appreciate it. Because there's, like, 8 billion people in San Jose, right? It's like a giant freaking city.
Huge. Mm-hmm.
It's huge.
Huge.
Okay, so there's got to be good late-night eats since it's not possible for there not to be. Anyway, Kevin writes, I'm thinking about buying a new 3-liter tabletop centrifuge for random mad science food hackery. What should I be looking for, refrigerated or not? Any manufacturers to avoid? Swinging bucket or fixed rotor? I'd like to be able to try out things like making nut and vegetable butters, tomato water, and clarifying stocks and juices. Our tabletop model is going to have enough oomph to handle this range of things. And while I'm asking questions, have you ever experimented with meat stock clarification in a centrifuge? I can imagine being able to get a beautifully clear stock, but is there flavor loss? I don't know if you if you don't know, I can do that experiment myself once I've acquired my centrifuge. Okay, what should you be looking for? Refrigeration is nice. I mean, I love having a refrigerator on my centrifuge, but that said, and there are some products that it's very helpful to have, but it obviously you need more power and it's a lot more space and the unit is a lot heavier. If you don't need the refrigeration, if you don't want it, you can get a much more compact system without refrigeration. So, and there are ways to get around the refrigeration. For instance, putting your buckets in the freezer before you load them so that they're cold, XYZ. Your product does heat up quite a bit in a centrifuge as it's spinning. And it's because of the incredible friction that's just generated by the this thing spinning around in the air. It gets quite warm. So we're talking the product that goes in pretty close to room temperature can come out at body temperature really at the end of like a 15-minute spin or something like that. So if you have a product that you where the temperature is critical, for instance, butter or spinning cream into this kind of butter mass, which is something that Wiley does at the WD-50 or has done, then refrigeration is probably a good idea. Another thing is because of the immense friction, the centrifuge can chill very, very rapidly. So one of the advantages that I think of having a refrigerated unit is, we'll do juices. When we're doing juices, I usually blend whatever fruit it is in a VitaPrep along with the enzyme until it's slightly above body temperature. That means the enzyme works almost instantaneously and we can spin right away. I don't have to wait for the enzyme to break down stuff at lower fridge temperatures. Now, if you have a refrigerated centrifuge, it chills that product as it's spinning extremely rapidly down to refrigerator temperatures just because there's such good heat transfer because of the immense amount of airflow that you're getting across the buckets when you're spinning. So refrigeration, if you can afford it in terms of space and in terms of money, then I would get it. I mean, that's that. Whether or not any manufacturers to avoid, I really only have experience with Sorval, larger Sorval units, and with what was that Japanese one? Do you remember the name of that? That thing was awesome.
No, I don't remember.
That thing was amazing.
Yeah.
I loved that thing.
I know.
That thing was awesome. And the one in Japan, which I can't even remember, was a Japanese manufacturer, and I don't think it's shipped here to the U.S. But the awesome thing about that, other than the fact that it was awesome, it was very compact, right? Mm-hmm. It had a plexi top, and there's some American, there's some manufacturers here that are I forget who, like Centrovap, I forget who makes those, but there's a couple manufacturers with plexi tops, and they're kind of fun because you can get a strobe tack and shoot on the thing, and then you know see the product as it's clarifying. It's not really necessary, but it is fun. But the awesome thing about that Japanese one was that the buckets, the aluminum buckets, had stainless steel thin inserts that went into it that you could just use over and over, and they're just really. It was a really nice unit and really quiet, smooth. Anyway, so most of my experience has been with Juans, and the Juan is nice, is a nice unit, but they're older because the company's out of business. It was bought by Thermo, which still makes a lot of centrifuges, and then the company was retired. The branding was retired. Wiley uses a Hedich. He seems to enjoy that, and I think Tony Conigliaro in England also uses a Hedich, and he likes it. I think Hedich is out of Germany, but you know, all these guys. Here's what I would say: I wouldn't avoid a manufacturer in a new centrifuge. I would avoid certain types. So, I don't think you need. Here's the other thing. So the question is fixed rotor versus swinging bucket. Fixed rotor is going to be better for things like pea butter and whatnot, just because of the way layers are formed in a fixed angle rotor. However, most of the fixed angle rotors, you can put a fixed angle rotor into a 3-liter benchtop thing, but you're not going to get 3 liters out of it. You're going to get a much smaller yield. And to buy a unit that can do 3 liters that's fixed rotor is going to be a much, much larger unit, and you're talking a lot more money. For bang for buck and most useful all around, go with the swinging bucket rotors because that's the clarification machine. It works fine on nut butters. How many things of nut butter have we done in a countless?
Countless, too many.
Nut milks, things of that nature. I've never actually done the pea butter recipe, but I think that when Maxime Billet came to the school, he did it in our centrifuge, mm-hmm. and it seemed to work fine. But the fixed angle rotors are good for certain. They're good for certain things, and I do some fixed angle work. Again, all of my recipes that I work with are built around that centrifuge and around its capabilities. So I spend most of my time thinking of recipes that fit within those parameters. So there's many things I'm sure that you can do that you can't. Now, on stock, I've never clarified stock in regular stock in a centrifuge, and I'm assuming that to do it, you're going to require a lot of G's unless you do things like break down the gelatin in it or add other fining agents to it. And then I'm assuming you'll be able to do it. But your question is that you're not sure if there's going to be flavor loss. There is always flavor loss in a clarification step. Let me be clear on this. There is always, always a flavor loss in a clarification step. The centrifuge by far is the least impactive technique to clarify that I've ever used. So, agar clarification strips out certain things and centrifuge strips out certain things, but things like agar and gelatin clarification strip out a lot more. Egg whites strip out a lot more. And how you clarify also determines how much is stripped out. So, I mean, even within something like the centrifuge is what I mean to say. So, I'll give you the for instance. We do gin and juice is one of the recipes we do at the bar. And I used to clarify grapefruit juice using freeze-thaw with agar. So, you use 2 grams per liter of grapefruit juice. You set a light agar gel. You freeze it for, tarred overnight. And then you let it thaw into big pans. And so, we used to do liters and liters and liters. Like, remember that time we did for the MoMA? We did a party for 1,500 or more people at the MoMA, and it was just gallons and gallons. We took every hotel pan in the school and filled it with frozen grapefruit juice.
And Lexans, remember that?
Yeah.
We squeezed them right.
Yeah, and your yield is lower, but the grapefruit juice you get from that technique, freeze thaw, is extremely clean and sweet because a lot of the bitterness of the grapefruit is stripped out, which is, I guess, Naringen, and it's stripped out in the agar clarification process. So when you make gin and juice using agar clarification, freeze thaw or quick, you do not need to add any simple syrup at all to the recipe. okay? When you do centrifugal clarification on grapefruit juice, where we use an enzyme to break down the pectin, and then some very light fining agents, kiesel sol and chitosan, which are designed for wine clarification, more of that inherent bitterness remains. Some of it's still stripped. It doesn't taste like fresh grapefruit, whole grapefruit juice, but it much more remains, such that I do have to add a small amount of simple syrup to that recipe to get it to work. And so, yes, there is a stripping of flavor. Sometimes that stripping of flavor is good. For instance, I wouldn't want the full bitterness of grapefruit juice in my gin and juice, because I think it would be overpowering with the gin and with the carbonation, because we carbonate it all. So there's always flavors that are removed. Sometimes it's a good thing. Sometimes it's a bad thing. With the stock, whenever I clarify stock, I usually am doing a bunch, and so I do regular freestyle clarification on stock. Just water it down so there's not too much gelatin in there. But you could use a fining agent in conjunction with an enzyme called Corallase, which breaks down gelatin. The problem with we've done tests of breaking down the gelatin using just meat protease stuffs, basically papain and other things that you can get as meat tenderizers. The problem being that when proteins are broken down into very small fragments, some of those fragments can turn bitter and unpleasant, the small polypeptides. And Corallase is an enzyme that's designed specifically to break down gelatin into flavorless polypeptides. So it breaks them down in such a way that they don't cause bitter and off flavors. And that stuff is freaking amazing. Unfortunately, you take jellied stock, hardcore jellied stock, you add a couple of drops of Corallase, and the thing melts out. Just melts. Even if it's cold, boop, gone. And then you can reduce stock. We've done ridiculous things, like take a gallon of stock and taking it down to, almost until it's solid, and it doesn't set when it cools off. So we use that for, these incredibly intense kind of beef stock things. It's amazing. But anyway, I would get a hold of Corallase, except for I have not been able to. So if Chris, if Chris at Modernist Pantry can get his hands on some Corallase enzyme, I would buy the hell out of that, because that's good stuff.
We met him.
Yeah, we did. We met him. What was it again? Was it here?
Saturday.
Oh, yeah. We did the Heritage Radio. Have we talked about that yet?
Sort of.
Here, you think about what to say about that, because I think I got one more question I got to hit before we get kicked out of here. And here it is. Confused in Houston. Confused in Houston Miles writes in, Dear Nastasha, Dave, Jack, and Joe, I've been researching hydrocolloids. Is it my Casey Kasem voice like that?
You don't like that.
You don't like it? All right. Fine. I've been researching hydrocolloids, and in particular, methylcellulose. Since there are a bunch of different kinds of this stuff, how can one tell which is right for a particular purpose? For example, if I wanted to make a hot melting jelly, which type of methylcellulose would I use? And what about for stabilizing a foam? Thanks in advance. Okay. This is a great thing and a great question. And a lot of this goes back to some original problems I had with recipes printed online, and also with Ferran's Texturas line. Now, the products in Texturas, they're all good products. They're all high quality products, but the problem is that they don't necessarily tell you what's in them. So, for instance, in Ferran's Gelan, it's just called Gelan. It's not just Gelan. It's a mixture of two different kinds of Gelan, high acyl Gelan and low acyl Gelan. That's, I guess, some sort of compromise that you can use to make fluid gels, but also has a somewhat gelatin characteristic when it's used as a gel in its own right. And I'm pretty sure it's been a billion years since I've used his Gelan, but I think it's basically 25% of the high acyl Gelan, which is the stretchy, weird one, and 75% of the low acyl, which is the brittle, clear, one that's good for fluid gels. So on methyl cell, I used to know it one time, and I've forgotten what they're actually using in that. Now, there are many different producers of methylcellulose. Methylcellulose is one of the few unnatural hydrocolloids that we use, and by that I mean that methylcellulose does not occur in nature. It's a derived product from cellulose, manufacture of cotton and things like this. And so they're not naturally occurring, but that doesn't make them evil. It just means they don't occur in nature. But there are a zillion different kinds. There's straight methylcellulose. There's hydroxypropyl methylcellulose. There's a bunch of different ones. And there are several manufacturers of it. The ones that I use and have used are manufactured by Dow. And Dow's brand name is Methocell, right? M-E-T-H-O, I can't spell it out loud. S-E-E-L. Methocel. And they, and those are the ones that most chefs write their recipes around. Dal Methocel. The good thing about Dal is that Dal has online, or they used to, and if they don't, I can email or put on my thing, a bunch of technical documents on exactly what they all do. So any recipe that you get, you should try to convert it into the type of methocel that you want. The interesting property that you allude to with methocel that it has is that it's one of the very few things that, as it's heated, becomes a gel. Gels as it's heated and melts as it's cooled. This has led to a lot of people, including Wiley and Ideas in Food, and you know, Nicholas Curti would have if he hadn't died before he figured out what methocel was, try and make things like hot ice cream, things that are solid when they're hot, and then you put it in your mouth and it melts. Kind of an inverse thing of ice cream. The problem is I think it's a fundamentally flawed idea, making hot ice cream, because like I can go into it later. I don't have time to go into why I think hot ice cream is a fundamentally flawed idea. But so it's a very interesting product because of this way that it sets as it's heated, and it's because it becomes less soluble as it's heated, drops partially out of solution, and forms a gel. Now, there's wide variety of ones in the methocel line, and not all of them form good gels, but they're arranged in the order of how they gel. So the hardest gelling one, but it actually squeezes out a lot of water, is the SG series, and those stands for super gelling. And those hard gelling ones also gel at the lowest temperature. The next series up, and it's very, very not that hot, like 120 Fahrenheit or something like that, starts gelling. I forget the actual numbers. The next is the A series. So those are the two ones that are mainly used for gels in things like noodles that set when you squeeze them into broths and all those things. That's what those things excel at, that kind of application. And they're used for that. The other series, I don't really use the K series that much, but it's a higher thing. The other series that I use, the E series, was discontinued. The E series is good at film forming, and so people are making crackers and biscuits out of them. I don't particularly like methocel E series, but the one that I use the most is the F series, and that's the one that you use for meringues and for whipping. So that's the one that's a good whipping agent. Okay, so the SG and the A series are the ones that you use for gelling, and the F series is the one that you use for like those meringues that you dehydrate and they stay nicely. The other thing to worry about on methocel, Dal brand methocel, is the number that is after it. So there's F50, for instance, is the one that you want to use for whipping things. The 50 is, and all of the numbers after a methocel are a measure of the viscosity of the product as it's made. So 50 is, it's in almost in arbitrary units, but it's a certain concentration of methocel has 50 times the viscosity of water at a certain concentration, blah, blah, blah. Okay? So there's F50, but there's, for instance, you can get one like SG 16M, right? And here's what's freaking confusing, and I'll leave you guys with this because they're going to kick us off the air in a second. But here's what's confusing. They use some combination of Arabic and Roman freaking numerals, right? So SG 16M, right, is actually an SG super gel with a viscosity of 16,000, because the M stands for 1,000 in Roman numerals. They also have some C ones that are like 700, and so it's very confusing unless you just remember you got to choose the series you want, and then after you choose the series you want, you got to choose the viscosity that you want it to be, and the viscosity is going to determine also how hard the gel is going to be at the end, because it's probably a longer, they're probably longer units, so they're probably a harder gel, and also the viscosity of the stuff as you're working. I hope that helps. Cooking issues.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening. Get it straight.